Welcome to Women on Air, a weekly show about women, feminism, and social justice, brought to you by CFUV's Women's Radio Collective.
So you're listening to CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria, and we also stream online at cfuv.uvic.ca. I'm Jen, your host for today. So for the most part, we're having some pretty interesting interviews. One is done by Wings. So if you follow feminist radio programs, Wings is the Women's International News Gathering Service. So I have a interview with them about women and bicycling. And then we dug into the archives of Women on Air to have the second half. But we're going to jump right into it with the Wings interview. So I hope that you enjoy.
Today on Wings, Women in Bicycling.
For more than 100 years, bicycling has been associated with women's liberation. In 1896, U.S. suffragist Susan B. Anthony famously declared, "I think the bicycle has done more to emancipate women than anything else in the world. It gives a woman a feeling of freedom and self-reliance. The moment she takes her seat, she knows she can't get into harm unless she gets off her bicycle. And away she goes, the picture of free, untrammeled womanhood." Since then, informal women-only groups, as well as more established cycling organizations, have been promoting bicycling for women. I'm Melinda Tuhus, and I recently spoke to some women cycling advocates.
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings.
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world, produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service. Melinda Tuhus is both a radio producer and a cyclist. In February 2014, she attended the 6th annual Youth Bike Summit in New York City. That's where she met young Ulana Mekutz.
I live in the neighborhood of Westtown Bikes, so me and my family were biking one day. This was summer of last school year, so 2012. And we were like, oh, we need to fix a flat or whatever. And so Sarah, who's our main director for Girls Bike Club, she was there and she was like, oh, you should come to Girls Bike Club. So I did, and that's every Wednesday. And I guess I've just been going ever since. And fall of last year, I was part of an ASM program there. So that's After School Matters. And you learn a craft or a trade, and you basically work at the place that you are learning it at, and you get paid for it in the end.
And so you were working at Girls Bike Club then?
I wasn't part of the shop because it was more of like learning how to work at a bike shop, I guess. So bike mechanics was a big part, bike safety. We went on a lot of rides together. It was a whole group.
What did you like about it?
I really liked the fact that I learned how to make a bike, fix a bike, take apart a bike, and put it back together. I actually made my the fixed speed that I ride right now. So,
but you were already a cyclist because you said you were riding with
your
family.
Oh yeah, I was already a biker. Yeah, but I didn't like my bike. It was pretty gross.
So you built your own.
Yeah.
And what kind of activities do you do now with the Girls Bike Club?
Now with the Girls Bike Club, we meet every Wednesday, and we do a variety of things. So sometimes we'll bring out the sewing machines, and we'll sew the hats that we're teaching people how to make today, and the pouches, and just make merchandise that we sell at fundraisers and other bike events in Chicago. So the Winter Bike Fashion Show, which is includes all bike shops in Chicago, and we also have our own fashion show, Heels on Wheels, which is what we mirrored this fashion show that we're producing at Youth Bike Summit. So
I noticed there's a lot of boys and men making stuff in there.
Absolutely. We want to be really inclusive, and I think it's important for everyone to make something with their hands. And our bike club, which is, we had bike club first at Westtown Bikes, and then that branched off into Girls Bike Club and Bike Club. So basically, the bike club is a boys' bike club, and they make tire belts, they make tire pouches, inner tube accessories, bracelets, buttons, and they screen print shirts as well. So we're all very crafty, I guess.
Wow. Is this your first time at the Bike Summit?
Yeah, it actually is.
What do you think?
I think it's really awesome meeting a lot of really cool people from all bike shops all over the country and the world, right? There's people from Canada.
Yep, I met a couple of them already.
I haven't met them yet, but that's really cool. I think that's awesome, just seeing the youth that do similar things to us and just what the bike culture is, where the, like how their how their bike culture is in their city, because it's always different.
Would you say that the Girls Bike Club, is it part about leadership development?
Definitely. I have learned so, along with the other girls in my group, I've learned so many like really necessary skills for just life and team building and teamwork. I mean, every fundraiser we've had, we've organized ourselves. So that includes like, well, I mean, we've used resources that other people have. So, you know, Alex, the director of our bike shop, we've learned how to put together an event, catering, finding a space, everything. So I think that's really useful in the future.
For sure. Well, great. Well, thank you so much. That was Ulana Makuts, a member of the Girls Bike Club in Chicago. I met her at the 6th Annual Youth Bike Summit in New York City this past February. I went to the Bike Summit because I've been a big advocate for the past dozen years of cycling for transportation as well as recreation in my hometown of New Haven, Connecticut. I've been biking almost everywhere I need to go since moving here more than 25 years ago. That's mostly trips of about 5 miles, sometimes less, sometimes more. Through Elm City Cycling, I've worked with young people to teach them the rules of the road and bike maintenance and have led them on fun rides. Cycling reduces air pollution and urban noise, saves lots of money on gas and car maintenance, and is great for my health. As we win more improvements, like separated bike lanes and more bike parking, and as we educate both motorists and cyclists on how to move safely through town, more and more residents are taking up two-wheeled transportation, which makes it safer for everyone. I've had a few close calls, but as I confidently take the lane, motorists make room for me. As one advocacy organization's name says, bikes belong. The first cycling group in the U.S. was the League of American Wheelmen, founded way back in 1880. In 1996, it finally changed its name to the League of American Bicyclists to reflect the growing interest by women in all kinds of cycling. Adonia Lugo is the Equity Initiative Manager of the League, which means she works to get underrepresented groups involved in cycling.
Bicycle advocacy is part of the larger focus on equity in the bike movement, and equity we're using as a sort of umbrella term to talk about issues of diversity and inclusion and looking at who is going to be served by infrastructure programs, education programs, and whatnot.
You were talking about a couple different models of ways to make change. Would you say they were opposites or contradictions of each other, or that in any way they were complementary?
I think that top-down change and grassroots change are complementary. So the diagram that I showed is something that came out of my research on what leads to more people thinking that bicycling is a good idea. And what I've learned in working with bike advocates for years is that a lot of bike advocates look to bike infrastructure, changing the design of streets, as a way to encourage more people to use bikes. And so there's a kind of assumption that the infrastructure, when it goes into place, is going to be legible to people. They're going to want to get out and ride. And I think that's often the case. But there's also a sort of culture change element that's assumed in bike infrastructure projects, where we're looking at how people use roads and we're saying, okay, how do you change the way people use roads? How do you change the way people think about roads and what they think is appropriate on a road? And what we do in bike advocacy generally is say, well, the way that you're going to change people's thinking is by changing the road. And what I found as an anthropologist is that we could also be thinking about changing our ideas about bicycling in communities, and then that's going to lead to changes in the street down the line. But what we can do as advocates is work more to listen to how people are talking about bicycling, how people are organizing bike rides for their communities, different things like that, to find out, you know, where bike change is happening and then support that.
Can you give any examples of how each of those has worked in any community that you're familiar with?
The basis of my dissertation research was helping to organize a few bike efforts in Los Angeles. One was doing outreach with day laborers who used bikes, and the other was helping organize an open street event called Ciclovia. And with City of Lights, the day laborer outreach project, we were talking to people who bike advocates had noticed, low-income Latino day laborers who were riding mountain bikes on sidewalks. They had been noticed, but we didn't really know how to connect with them. And so we started organizing bilingual volunteers who could do more targeted bike safety education, getting participation in policy processes with this population, doing stuff like that. So that emphasized to me that when you have people who have cross-cultural abilities, who can be that bridge between different groups, then you can be getting more voices into bike advocacy and then creating bike policy that's going to serve more people. The other thing I worked on, Ciclovia, the kind of theory of open street events is culture change. It's you give people an opportunity to use their streets differently, and that's going to have an impact on maybe their commutes or how they're thinking they're going to, you know, what transportation choices they're going to make down the line. And so it's a kind of experimental space where new things are possible. So both of those projects really encouraged me to think about how there's a lot of work that we do as bike enthusiasts and as bike advocates in terms of sharing ideas with each other about, you know, better bike routes, gear, all kinds of stuff. And that is a really important piece of how we get more people into bicycling. And so what I've written about academically is calling that human infrastructure. So the bike infrastructure projects that we advocate for should be augmented by the cross-cultural work of building human infrastructure across different types of communities.
One of the best ways to get more people out biking, like in Europe, is to have separated bike lanes. You know, when you did your rundown of policy change, it was, you know, you have this idea, and then you get legislation, and then you get the structure built, and then it would change people's behavior. And apparently that is true. But I'm thinking about, like in New Haven, people who don't think about biking and don't have a bike, and if there were a separated bike lane, they chances are wouldn't think it was for them. So in terms of cultural change, like, say, African-American or Latino women who live in the city, and biking could be a really great thing for them for exercise, but also just getting around, and if they don't have a car, it could be great, but they just don't think it's for them, and they don't see themselves there. So how might the cultural model be used to sort of bring them into the fold or have them see themselves on a bike?
Well, the way that that has been taking shape around the country in the last, really since the late 90s, is that there's an increasing number of bike clubs or just more informal community rides that are really about bringing together people who share a cultural identity and then bicycling together. So there are a lot of different Major Taylor bike clubs around the country, Major Taylor being the best bicyclist in the world back at the beginning of the 20th century, and he was African American. He was able to cross a lot of color lines that no other racers were able to. And so he's become a really important symbol of diversity in bicycling. So we've got a lot of Major Taylor clubs. You have community rides like Red Bike and Green is something that started up in Oakland. An African-American young woman started that, and then it spread to other cities like Atlanta, Chicago, and here in New York, too.
It's called Red Bike and Green?
Red Bike and Green, yeah. In that group, they make a very explicit connection to community empowerment. So how this is a ride that celebrates Black bike culture. And so they're putting an emphasis on the fact that there are different kinds of bike cultures out there. That's been something that has been unintentionally limiting about the way that we promote bicycling here in the U.S. is there's a lot of assumptions made about what's going to be appealing across the board. And the reality is we have a lot of different cultures that coexist here in the States, and coming up with some ways to promote bicycling to different groups can be enhanced by seeing how those different groups are embracing bicycling. So another example would be Black Women Bike DC, which is a group led by a really cool lady, Veronica Davis. And there's a group in Los Angeles called the Ovarian Psychos. That's Chicana young women who have a ride called Clitoral Mass to kind of...
They're out there. Wow, that's great. I hadn't heard about those.
So yeah, there's a lot of this happening around the country. And what I'm interested in as an advocate is making some more connections between the kind of bike culture that these groups are creating for themselves and how we support bicycling with policy.
I met somebody who got some funding to do an outreach program with Girl Scouts through the League of American Bicyclists.
That grant was through the Women Bike Program. The Women Bike Program has been around for a couple years now. They've had a few really great in-person meetings, and they funded a few pilot projects for some different groups around the country that were coming up with some new ideas and ways of engaging with women around bikes. And so the Girl Scouts project that was in Philadelphia was one of those.
On Wings, you're listening to Women and Bicycling. You can comment on this program by emailing wings@wings.org. Now back to Melinda Tuhus speaking with anthropologist and bike equity advocate Adonia Lugo at the 6th Annual Youth Bike Summit in New York.
What role do you think the Youth Bike Summit plays in equity and in getting people of different backgrounds on bikes?
The Youth Bike Summit, this is my first year here, but it's something I've heard about for a while because I knew people in Seattle and Portland who were involved in organizing it, and I've met people through the League and the Equity Advisory Council at the League who've also been very important to getting the Youth Bike Summit going. And what I've noticed as someone who got into bicycling through a kind of DIY co-op collectives world is that there are a lot of people who are doing really cool work with bikes and using bikes as a tool for community change, doing Earn a Bike programs, they've got bike collectives, they're recycling bikes in different ways. These are folks who are very aware of bicycling being something of a survival strategy for low-income families, and they've got their ear to the ground, they're doing great cross-cultural work with kids, and I think that they have a lot of important knowledge that we can use in bike advocacy. So I think that the Youth Bike Summit is doing a tremendous job of just strengthening that network, and people are sharing ideas, and they're really getting to have more influence, I think, because they can show, you know, all these different success stories where they've done a really good job of connecting with kids and communities through bikes.
There was one more thing I wanted to ask you. There was a pie chart divided into, I guess it was four income brackets, from the lowest to the highest and the two in between, and it was almost identical, the percentages of people who biked for any reason within those different income brackets. And then recently, the new study I saw was people who use a bike as transportation for bike commuting, and the highest quartile certainly was low-income people. But what we see in New Haven is, a lot of cyclists, you know, could do better following the laws and also wearing helmets and using lights at night. But that population is almost exclusively non-helmet wearing and non-light using, and often don't have any idea about the, you know, the laws, and often ride against traffic, which also a lot of young teenagers do. I mean, I don't know if they know the rules or not, but I'm sure they do it on purpose anyway. It was like the young man at your workshop was talking about salmoning when you ride against traffic. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's it's scary, especially when they do it at night with no lights. So do you think it's important to reach that population, you know, at least with safety information or safety equipment, even if I think a lot of them don't consider themselves part of the quote-unquote cycling community.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, but they are. Mm-hmm. I mean, if they're out on a bike, they are. So, or at least they're cycling, whether they're part of the community or not. I mean, but we're trying in New Haven. We've tried different things to, you know, reach out to them and mm-hmm. help them ride safer. But what do you think? What have you done about that?
My experience in Los Angeles, which is a city that's fortunate to have, you know, a tremendous amount of diversity in the population, and a lot of people who grew up in neighborhoods that were more ethnic enclaves and then now have this kind of ability to kind of cross between different cultural settings, we were able to use that as a resource in organizing the City of Lights project. And the thing that we were doing, like the actual engagement we were doing with people, was giving out bike lights because of this issue of people not necessarily having access to lights and helmets and information about bike laws. The City of Lights project, over the years, became actually a larger, a more broad project to focus on creating a safety curriculum in Spanish and doing more workshops in Spanish. And, I mean, that's kind of a it's a baseline issue that we have in the bike movement, that a lot of our materials are not bilingual. They're not available in, you know, we should be providing our materials in all of the languages that are common in the U.S., and we don't necessarily do that. So that's one thing, making sure that things are translated and available, but also really just capitalizing on the people who have the ability to kind of talk across different groups and really, you know, represent the concerns of one group to another. And, you know, as the U.S.'s demographics are changing, we're going to see in the future more and more people who have those abilities. But at this point in time, we still have a lot of places in this country where people have managed to sort of avoid, you know, for better or for worse, contact with different groups. And so we're seeing, I really believe that one of the big barriers we have to getting bikes to more people is the reality that we've had segregated communities for a really long time. And unfortunately, the wonderful civil rights gains of the mid-20th century got somewhat dampened by the shift to suburbs and driving and people preferring to spend time isolated from communities. And so what we're dealing with now is people realizing, for sustainability reasons, for economic reasons, for, you know, just wanting to have a better life reasons, that living in cities is a kind of a good thing, and more people are wanting to spend time together and live in closer proximity. But we never really healed those wounds and kind of repaired those divides. And so things like bicycling now are becoming a symbol of urban change. And for some people, it's a good symbol, and for others, it's a symbol of something they can't control.
That was Adonia Lugo, the Equity Initiative Manager for the League of American Bicyclists. I met her at the 6th Annual Youth Bike Summit in New York City this past February.
About a month after the Youth Bike Summit, an article by Leslie Evans Ogden appeared in Pacific Standard magazine, confirming that percentages of active cyclists who are female rise sharply where cycling is made safer. In Denmark, 55% of cyclists are women, and some other European countries have 50%. Percentages of women riders in North America are much lower, but rising as policies change. Ogden cites a study of a street in Vancouver, Canada, where a painted bike lane got an added physical barrier to separate bikes from cars. The percentage of riders who are female on that street rose from 28% to 37% within 2 years. Wings producer Melinda Tuhus telephoned Mia Kohout, founder of Vancouver-based Momentum Magazine, to find out more about women and cycling in Canada.
Our goal is to normalize cycling and to show it as a fun, easy, convenient, sexy way to get around. And I think we are making it easier for people to try riding again. And we're also creating images and a perception of cycling that is different from what it may have been portrayed, particularly in North America, as a sport recreation activity in the past. In Vancouver and Toronto and Montreal, there's been a steady increase of people who are riding bikes to get around the city. And particularly, I'm seeing a lot more women who are riding bikes around the city. And the trend has definitely also been towards a more European style of riding, where people wear normal clothes. It's fairly common these days in cities like Montreal and Toronto to see women, you know, biking in skirts and high heels. And we see this, too, happening in Vancouver, but not at the same rate. Cycling in Vancouver is still very practical, functional. Maybe people are riding longer distances, and so you see a lot more gear than you do in center cities of Toronto and Montreal. And then this is kind of what we're also, what we're seeing really globally is just that a lot more people are riding in cities, and in particular, a lot more women are riding in cities. Traditionally and statistically, in cities across Canada, the cycling population has been about 75% men and 25% women, but this is changing quite drastically and quite quickly in cities where you're we're seeing a much more balance of almost 50% men, 50% women riding. Safety improvements in these cities, and then also just as more people start riding, people see other people doing it, and it becomes more feasible for people to consider trying it themselves. The barriers to entry still are a lack of infrastructure. It has been said, I don't know if I believe this, but it has been said that women are more risk-averse than men when it comes to riding. And without infrastructure, it is it can be, you know, scarier, the perception of danger for people who might want to take up riding, but also family commitments, like figure out how to, you know, maybe get their children to daycare. You know, there are solutions for transporting children by bicycle, but this is kind of an extra step to getting on a bike, is also figuring out how to get your kids on a bike and how you're going to get around. So those are the barriers that I see. What we're seeing happening all over the world, but what's happening much more quickly in Europe, is building safe bike infrastructure. And when I talk about safe bike infrastructure, I mean protected bike lanes. That is bike lanes physically separated from traffic. And this is trending in cities all over the world, but it's happening at a significant pace in places like Seville, Spain, where they had less than 1% mode share of cycling within the last 5 years ago. And then they built 1,200 kilometers of protected bike lanes within 5 years, and their mode share went from 1% to 7%. And so, like, that is just such a great example, because people are always, you know, oh, we always look at Copenhagen, we always look at Amsterdam, and they seem so unattainable. But then you can look at to a city like Seville, who basically built bike infrastructure overnight and has seen a significant increase in the number of people riding in such a short time. And so this is really what I see is the most important thing that we need to do if we want to have more people, particularly women, riding on streets, is we need to build protected bike lanes.
That was Mia Kohout of Momentum magazine. Cycling is still a women's issue internationally today. A recent story on NPR, U.S. National Public Radio, featured the Afghan Women's Racing Team, a fledgling group that risks road rage and other violence to pursue the sport they love. The first feature-length film by a Saudi woman, Wajda, is about a girl struggling for the right to ride a bicycle. Recently, I saw a new documentary called Half the Road, a title that invokes the Chinese adage that women hold up half the sky. It documents the appalling discrimination against women bicycle racers in the U.S. and around the world, and their fight for equal access to training, to entering races, and to equal prize money. One proposed rule was that women couldn't race if they were menstruating. When one female cyclist inquired if race directors would carry out panty checks to enforce the rule, they abandoned the proposal. For Wings, I'm Melinda Tuhus reporting.
To finish off this half hour, let's turn back the clock to 1893, when this anonymous poem appeared in the Toronto Mail and was reprinted in the Los Angeles Herald. The Bicycle Girl. The bicycle girl is plump and round, her cheeks are rosy, her skin is browned, her eyes are bright with health, in her modest gowns of navy blue she gets all the admiration due to a woman's greatest wealth. Her flesh is firm and her muscles strong, her rounded limbs might well belong to a goddess of olden time. As she glides along on her silent wheel, all men admire, for all men feel, that her vigor is sublime. Then hail to the bicycle girl, and long may she live and grow more strong, as a woman ought to do, till her weaker sisters also try, with her in her health and her strength to vie, and get them bicycles too. Wings is a weekly half-hour program which has been in distribution since 1986. To hear Wings programs again, email wings@wings.org. And follow our daily news feed on Facebook, facebook.com/wingsradio. Wings thanks all our supporters, especially your local community radio stations. Give generously if your station has a fund drive, and please say that you enjoy listening to Wings. Our longest individual supporters are Suzette Cullen and Genevieve Vaughn, whose many books include the pamphlet-length 35 Steps Toward a Gift Economy, available online. The Wing Sound logo is from Libana's album A Circle is Cast. I'm the Wing series producer, Frieda Werden. Wing stands for Women's International News Gathering Service.
But back to our show, and here is the interview with Rita Golden, or not an interview, sorry, a book review for Rita Golden Gelman.
Today, we're going to indulge our wanderlust a little. We have Samantha Rubin in studio with us, and she's going to talk to us about Rita Golden Gelman, a woman who seems to have done quite a bit of traveling in her life. So, hi, Samantha.
Hello, Genevieve. Thank you for having me here, and hello, everyone.
It's lovely to have you.
Yes, pleasure to be here. I'm so excited about this lady. I love her, and I haven't even met her. So, you know, she's just endeared me to herself right away. So I'll just talk a little bit about Rita's bio, her history. So Rita Golden Gelman was, we'll flash back to the mid-80s. She was living the glamorous life, very privileged existence in Los Angeles. And she was married to an editorial consultant to some very top magazines in L.A. So she went to a lot of premieres, a lot of, you know, media-driven award ceremonies, that kind of thing. Just really out and about in the public eye all the time and, you know, attending countless dinners and these kinds of things. So she felt that this was really not her life, although that's what it appeared to be. And she always felt, you know, sort of lonely, and hearkening back to what happened to that adventurous spirit, you know, that young woman who really wanted to be an intrepid traveler. And so she just felt this increasing longing to go abroad and really travel, but it just wasn't happening for her. She just realized, yeah, that she had lost her spirit and she wanted to get it back. So one day she was on an airplane, and the person, the passenger sitting next to her, started recounting some of her very adventurous tales, and Rita just started weeping, and she thought, why am I not doing this? You know, my life, my soul is calling me to do this, and I'm ignoring it. So she went back and spoke to her husband, and she found that after almost 25 years of marriage, they basically had nothing in common. He did not wish to travel at all, and she wanted to travel the world. And so she thought, I need to, you know, really pursue this. I can't ignore this any longer. So she tried to reconcile with her husband, and then they ended up taking a break. And so she took a very pivotal voyage. The first one was to the Galapagos Islands, and she just loved it. It was a solo, her maiden voyage, if you will, solo. And she loved it, and she thought, that's it. I have to do this. You know, this is my life. Then she went back and spoke with her husband again, and they couldn't reconcile. He suggested that they could take a break. She went then for 2 months solo to Mexico to live among villagers there, because in her philosophy, she doesn't want to just go and be a voyeur. She had some training in anthropology, and she thought, no, I want to go and live amongst people wherever that is I may be, and cook with them, laugh with them, cry with them, live with them if possible. So she went for 2 months to Mexico, and that was it. She was sold, and it was, her life was irrevocably changed. So, she ended up at the age of 48. This is in 1986, divorcing her husband after 25 years. Her children were grown. She had a boy who was a freshman in college, and then her daughter was in 12th grade. So she was just about to graduate. And she thought, I don't need to do the full-time mom thing anymore. My children can, you know, take care of themselves. She sold all of her possessions. And since that time, she has not had a fixed permanent address. The only address she has is her email address. So she calls herself a modern day nomad. And this is her life. She decided, I want to go and live and breathe and experience all that the world has to offer. And that's what she did. And so, she also has among many of her philosophies that she accepts whatever is offered to her in the way of food or drink. She wants to just experience everything. And she realized, you know, that for so long, she did the, you know, sort of good girl thing, good wife, wise mother thing, where she did not allow herself to explore this, and now she was going to go whole hog. So she did. And she was able to finance her, she calls it her travel addiction, through, because her husband was in the publishing world, and she's published over 70 children's books. So one of them is actually a staple in first grade classrooms in the U.S. And so she's able to finance her travel in that way. But she also stays, she travels mostly to developing nations where, you know, her dollar stretches quite a lot further than it would elsewhere. So, yeah, she has a website, RitaGoldenGelman.com, and she has a number of different projects that she's really very passionate about, which I'll speak about later. But so her first adult book was called Tales of a Female Nomad Living at Large in the World, and that was about her maiden voyages, so to speak, how she just started living without a permanent address and being, you know, living a nomadic life. And at the end of that book, much to her publisher's dismay, she published her email address at the end of the book and said, please, folks, I'd love to hear about if this inspired you, you know, how you are going out and about in the world and challenging yourself and looking at fear and not letting it keep you back. And, you know, I'd love to hear your stories, so share them with me if you have them. Well, her publisher was afraid that she'd get, you know, inundated with a barrage of emails, and she sure did. She got thousands. Women were, you know, it's funny, she said half of the women were either saying, oh my gosh, you've inspired me so much, but I could never do that. Oh, I just could never. And other people were saying, you're such an inspiration. I've been doing this my whole life, and here's some of the things that I've done. So that's how her second adult book came into existence, and that's the one I'm going to review today. It's called Female Nomad and Friends, Tales of Breaking Free and Breaking Bread Around the World. So she basically sorted through with a friend this barrage of, you know, thousands of emails and thought, let's put together an anthology. And that's what this is. It's an anthology of 41 different authors, and they have recipes as well, because somebody, one of her, I think actually many of the women who emailed her said, hey, why don't you have a cookbook? You know, it seems like in a lot of your travels, you go, you know, attend cooking classes and you're together with, you know, women cooking in kitchens and, you know, I'm sure you have lots of great recipes. And she thought, I'm not suited to make a, you know, publish a cookbook. But through these ladies who had emailed her, she asked, put a call out for recipes as well, and through the advice of one of her friends, she thought, well, why don't I couple some recipes with the stories? And that's what this book became. So the book, all of the proceeds, I would like to add, every bit of the proceeds from the second book go to a cause that she's very, very passionate about. And it's basically, she lived for a year in New Delhi, India. And she had set up a special fund to send high school graduates from the slums in New Delhi to vocational schools so they could have a better life and have some educational advancement and, you know, a chance at a better life. So she basically already told people, if you're selected for this anthology, you will not get any of the proceeds. They're all going to this project to send kids to vocational school. And everybody agreed, and they said, that's wonderful. So she asks in the book, if you could please spread the word, and, you know, by you purchasing it, telling your friends about it, them purchasing it, and so on, all of the funds go to those kids in New Delhi who are looking to go to school. So, it's just basically, the book's a celebration of diversity. And, you know, a tribute to the shared humanity that we all have. And also, many of the stories are funny, are heartbreaking, are sad, are goofy. It's just the whole, you know, vibrant spectrum of the human existence, right, and the human experience. So in this anthology, she highlights stories from, there's so many different countries that she has people writing about. Some people wrote about their time in Israel, in Argentina, in Vietnam, in Fiji, in Samoa, in Latvia, Armenia, Suriname, and so on. The list goes on and on. So it's certainly not exclusive to one country. It's all over the map. And like I said, there's some stories that are very, very moving. The book is divided up into sections. So the sections are, like, there's themes, mm-hmm. like connecting, mixed messages, language, passion, and food.
So I imagine you'd get some very touching stories and some fun ones, perhaps some tragic ones,
Absolutely.
Kind of a mixed bag of everything.
Absolutely.
I was going to say, because you do hear a lot of, you know, the women's travel stories, you kind of got the eat, pray, love side of it, where it's about self-discovery and learning about you, and it's very on the traveler. And then you've got, you know, the other side of it, where you see women who travel who become victimized or who fall into bad situations.
Yes.
So it's kind of refreshing to see something that's outside of those two situations.
Mm-hmm. And I think it's also very inspirational, you know, for people reading this. Maybe someone who, like Rita also talks about, everybody has a different definition of what taking a risk is. For some people, taking a risk is, like Rita did, relinquishing your possessions and living a nomadic lifestyle for, you know, 2 decades, right? For other people, taking a risk is, this is mentioned in the book, one woman wrote her and said, "Thank you so much. I now have the courage to go across the street and talk to this Vietnamese family that moved into our neighborhood 3 years ago, and I've never had the courage to go and talk to them." That was a risk for this particular woman. So, you know, it's all different because we're all different human mm-hmm. beings, right? So Rita really wants to celebrate that diversity and show, hey, anyone who's taking a risk, I applaud you for doing that. And so as a woman, when you are a solo traveler, excuse me, as I have been many, many times, there is a vulnerability that is there that I would say is not there with men. Because you are susceptible, unfortunately, sometimes to sexual advances, unwanted attention, especially when you're traveling alone. And in some countries, people don't understand. The first question they ask you is, "Where's your husband?" Mm-hmm. Why aren't you traveling with your husband? And if you're not married, then that's unheard of. And a woman traveling alone, well, that's just improper. So it's really inspirational, I think, for women of all ages. All ages. Because Rita now, I believe she's in her, let's see, I think maybe 70s. And she's still living this existence, you know, nomadically. I think it's wonderful. So some of the stories are, you know, really hilarious. There were some that were quite funny. One, Rita talks about, this one's called the beauty contest, where she was living in a Thai village and her landlords of the bungalow that she was living in, she didn't speak any Thai, so they were sort of pantomiming. They grabbed her and motioned, "Okay, we're going to this event." And she's like, "Okay, I gotta just go with it. Let's go." So she ends up attending this event. They're in this big hall and it's a beauty contest, and she's thinking, "Wow, everybody's so beautiful, but there's something a little bit different here." And she finds out at the end of it they were all male transvestites. So she went and judged. She was asked to judge, you know, in the beauty contest. So that part was, you know, quite funny. And she said, "Isn't that great that I was open to the experience?" And she didn't have any preconceived notions. How could she? Because she didn't speak the language, so she didn't know where they were going, right? Another one was, I was particularly moved by this, a woman, it's called an awakening. There was a woman who was volunteering, working in a medical clinic in Uganda during the Civil War. And there were representatives from displacement camps who would come to the medical clinic to sign, you know, patients up who wanted to visit the clinic. And a lot of the patients had malaria, AIDS, typhoid, and they ran out of medicine for many people, and some people died. And so this woman, it really had such an impact on her life that she still thinks about it, her time, you know, and that was many years ago that she volunteered and she wanted to contribute that, you know. So she ended up having a breakdown at one point and thinking, I don't know if I can do this. And it was, I believe, a 6-week volunteer program. So that obviously changed her life, you know, going and doing something like that. And that was a big risk for her to take. So, there's some funny food ones, you know, she talks about, like some people, one woman went to Armenia and ended up eating calf's foot soup, which she was really quite frightened about, but thought, "Hey, I'm here. I want the experience." Another woman talks about worms, eating worms. There's all kinds of fun, crunchy goodies in the recipes. And the nice thing is that with the recipes in this book, they have, Rita and a whole panel of people have tried and tested all of the recipes, so they know, because a lot of these were sort of, they were handed down, you know, orally through, from mother, grandmother to mother to daughter. So they had to take note and write all these down. They thought, well, if we're publishing these in a book, we have to make sure that they're, you know, tried and true. So she does also list for some ingredients that people might not be familiar with. She'll list where you can purchase those. So that's good. But, you know, a lot of the common themes are people taking a risk and, like, love conquering fear, chasing your dreams, also some heartache, challenges. One woman talks about her voyage. There's a Camino de Santiago in Spain, which is a pilgrimage that many people go on. She talks about her experience there. So there's spirituality in here as well. There's, you know, some lighthearted humor, and it's just a wonderful, wonderful book. The only critique that I have out of all of this was, out of 41 authors in total, there were two male authors, the rest were women. And I felt that it was sort of gratuitous. Like, it felt to me like maybe she was placating someone to make it become more inclusive, you know, rather than just exclusively female authors. And I don't think there's anything wrong with having it just be exclusively female authors. I guess that's just my only critique of the book. Because it seemed very incongruous. Like, there's just two men out of this whole anthology. I thought, well, I mean, you know, if you're going to make it both men and women, then put more men, right? Instead of just the obligatory two. So, yeah, I felt that was a bit odd. But yeah, one love story really touched my heart about this woman who, chapter was called Fairy Godmothers Who Needs Them. And these chapters are really, really short. Some are one page, some are two, some are three, because it is an anthology and you have so many people in here. It's so easy to read. So for people who maybe don't want to sit down with a big tome and think, oh God, I'm going to have to, you know, slog my way through this, you can just read one chapter of one page and put it down, right? And come back to it. And I've read the book now a few times, and I keep reading the stories over and over again, the ones that I love. So the Fairy Godmothers Who Needs Them, this woman met the love of her life in the Seychelles. She was there, it was the last week of her vacation, and she was sort of estranged from her husband. And so during the last week, she met this man, and she thought, oh, isn't this lovely, this is great, wonderful, but you know, it's vacation, whatever, I'm going back home. And she then decided, because that gentleman who she met was staying there for a month-long vacation, and she was just there for the week, she went back home, and she thought, you know what? I cannot miss this opportunity. I have to go back and see if he's still there, and if it was really like meeting my soulmate, my beshert, or if it was just a one-week thing, and that was it. So against all odds, she's trying her hardest to get to the Seychelles, which is not an easy task. And she ended up enlisting in the help of the people. I think it was Air Seychelles, the staff there. They were so taken with her story that they wanted to get her there. So she got there, and the taxi driver thinks she's nuts because it's like the middle of the night, and she says, just drop me off at this banana shack or something. He's like, no, I want to drop you off at like a proper hotel. She said, no, because she knew that's where her gentleman friend was staying, near that place. That's what she remembered. Well, she ends up getting dropped off there, and somebody saw her and alerted the guy, and he came, and he was absolutely overjoyed, and they fell in love, and they got married, and they've been together ever since, and she lives there now. So it's a lot of stories like this about women just taking a chance, following their intuition, taking a chance and going for it. And I love it. It just celebrates, you know, our spirit.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, that's nice to see that in the context of travel, but you can definitely put that into other aspects of your life. As you were saying, some of the women who emailed her said, you know, they were able to take risks about, you know, walking across the street and speaking to people.
Mm-hmm.
But that's obviously applicable to lots of different things.
Absolutely. Men and women, anyone. You know, basically what I think Rita is trying to inspire people and encourage people to do through this book is, you know, just planting a seed, right? So you read a story and you think, wow, well, you know, I've always wanted to try such and such. Like, what if it's just even as simple as taking a class? Like, maybe you always wanted to try, you know, to learn how to sing, but you've always held yourself back and felt fearful. I think this is applicable to anyone, this
mm-hmm.
book, really. And it inspired me because I started to think about in my life, you know, where are some areas that I could be more intrepid? Because I think we all need to, you know, take a risk. Nothing ventured, nothing gained. That's what they say, right?
And I think so many, you know, young people, young women as well, are really interested in going out and having that travel experience, especially after or during their university career. But you tend to flock to the resorts and to the cities. Might be interesting to go off the beaten path.
Go to Armenia and eat, you know, calf's foot soup, right? I mean, for me, when I was a young woman, I'm still a young woman, but when I was in my early 20s, I decided, you know what? I have always wanted to go. I was an exchange student. I've been an exchange student, actually, in three different countries, and I feel very fortunate in that I grew up in a family where they realized that we need to get out and about and go and see the world, and my whole family's like that, so we've traveled quite a bit, and I was encouraged to do so. So after being an exchange student in France in high school, I knew I really wanted to go back to Europe, and I thought, all right, I'm going to go. So I saved my shekels, and I decided to go for 6 months. But I didn't have that finite time or plan, but I thought, okay, I'm going to go and check it out, and I went by myself. And some people, my family was like, great, go for it. That's wonderful. Have a good time. And some people, you know, received me in a way that, wow, that's kind of scary. What are you going to do about this and that and this and that and all these doubts? And I said, you know, I'm just going to go. I have to go and I'm going to enjoy myself. And at that time, you could get a year rail pass for like 3 months. I don't know if you can do that anymore. But so I just rode the train everywhere and I thought, you know, it's like if it's Tuesday, it must be Belgium. I'm like, okay, I'm going to try this place and I'm going to try this. And sometimes I'd, you know, go at a very leisurely pace and other times I wouldn't. But I just thought I have to go do it and try. And that I had the travel bug bit me. I think I have some, you know, nomadic genes. But that started me off on my solo travels. And I saw, especially as a young woman, it really empowers you. You can see that you are able to take care of yourself, that you are solely responsible for yourself, that you're in another country where you might not speak the language, and you can go ahead and do it. Mm-hmm. I was so excited and delighted to go on that trip because it built so much self-confidence. And that's what I think is really important for young women, especially, build that confidence. And so Rita's project that she's really adamant about now is this national movement that she founded called Let's Get Global, which ties into what I was saying, where she has, it's a mission to increase the number of American, United States youth who spend time living in other cultures. So she really wants to promote that. And it's, she has a website, it's letsgetglobal.org. So that's her current passion. She really wants to inspire people to go and travel and leave their sphere of influence at least once in their lives.
Yeah, interesting to see how, because the way we think the world is not necessarily how it is other places. So mm-hmm. Really cool to get a taste of that. Mm-hmm. If this has piqued your interest, I believe her books are available fairly widely.
Mm-hmm.
That'd be something interesting to check out. Yeah, so I know a lot of people do have that wanderlust, so pursue it if you'd like. I will say proceed with caution in some areas. You know, listen to that intuitive voice that'll lead you where you need to go. Just share a little bit more about being a female nomad and traveling and learning more from actually going out and doing. So let's hear.
Mm-hmm.
I know you wanted to share some of your own experiences as well.
Mm-hmm. I'd love to. I think for me, you know, it was just so important to get out there and go solo. Like I've always traveled solo. It's only until fairly recently that I've traveled with friends. So, and because of that, I just wanted to touch on something you said earlier about, you know, how it can be, taking a risk. Women, we're vulnerable. And so if we go, alone, it's really, really important to trust your intuition. And so I really, I'm very attentive about cultivating my intuition on a daily basis. And you must listen to your inner voice when you're out in the world, because especially if you're in a culture that is so radically different from your own, you don't know, you have no idea what to expect. And if you also have a language barrier, that can further exacerbate it. So it's really important just to listen to your voice. And I've been in a number of situations. I traveled, like I said, solo by myself through Europe, through Asia, and also through North America, including Mexico. And, so there were times when I thought, you know what, I don't feel safe and I don't wish to go to this particular city or this particular country or this. And I realized that that's my own presupposition. That's my own, you know, perception of it. But it didn't matter. I was trusting my inner voice. And I think that's absolutely essential for women. I really want to encourage women, if you do feel inclined to go and travel, do it, but trust your voice. So, you know, I've been chased. I remember I was in Singapore and this guy from Jakarta, Indonesia is chasing me, screaming down the street his phone number. And I'm thinking, what the heck is this? You know, and he's running after me and running after me, and I was alone. And I ended up ducking into a little small department store and looking at the woman, the clerk, and saying, please help me, this guy's chasing me. You know, because I knew I needed to get away from this guy and I didn't want to engage any further, right? But that didn't put me off of traveling. It's like, okay, so, you know, you have some guy who wants to, you know, run after you. Well, whatever. I'm not going to let that, you know, put a damper on my trip. So I've had that happen. I've been certainly groped in certain places on my body and also in certain geographical locations. But again, it's like, you know what? I'm not going to let this get me down. I remove myself from the situation if I feel unsafe at any time. And I also let people know, hey, that's not okay. And, you know, and sometimes, again, you can gauge. Like, I remember being in the countryside in Japan and having these a woman and a man who were farmers come up and grab my breasts. Wow, look at those. Like, okay, folks, yeah, show's over, this is not cool, okay? Just letting people know where your boundaries are, so it's really important, and I think that it gets developed further when you are traveling solo. Your boundaries get more and more concrete, and you become, you know, more attentive to your inner voice. So I've had wonderful experiences and sometimes some scary ones, but it didn't stop me. Some of my favorite times have been when I'm just alone and I don't even know where I'm going. I don't have a map and I just let myself wander. You're also forced to talk to people when you travel on your own, as opposed to if you're with a friend. So when you travel on your own, you are more likely to strike up a friendship. I was on a train, you know, I remember I was on a train, I think it was in, I don't remember if it was in Belgium, it was someplace in Western Europe, it's all a blur now, but I was talking with a bunch of people in the car, you know, and this one saying, hey, come to my house, hey, come to my country, hey, come to my country. Now, you know, I might not have struck up that conversation if I were with a friend, but I was alone, and I wanted some companionship and some, you know, a chat, so I just started to talk to people. So it really opens you up as a person. It broadens your horizons, and once you see that you can actually, you know, take on that fear and take a risk, it gets easier and easier each time. So I never hesitate to travel alone. I mean, going through Mexico for a couple months by myself,